Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening.
You can walk an island way and you work all the dough and dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
So we said we were going to limitize it today, which means, as you know, just wing it. Fancy talk for winging it. Is there anything, what's on your soul right now?
You know, I don't know. I think I'm often all over the map, unfortunately. But I was really fascinated when my friend steered me to your blog, and I read one or two posts, and I don't remember which right now. But then I realized your last name was Horsley, and I was like, oh, I know some Horsleys. And what was also very strange to me is that when Anita and Dylan and Natasha came over and they joined the friend school that we all attended briefly, I was strangely fascinated by where they came from.
Okay, well, see, you've taken me off guard now. I didn't... No, I didn't know that you knew them at all.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It's all right.
I wrote something to you in the blog thinking you would moderate it and not post it. And so I assumed you'd read that and said, okay, fine, that's lovely information, but that doesn't need to be on public. Although I kept it without names.
Oh, no, I don't remember reading it. And I certainly don't remember not letting any of your comments through. So that's interesting.
Oh,
yeah.
So let me back up.
Yeah.
So I grew up in Baltimore, and, in, I guess it was 78, Natasha and Anita and Dylan's family moved to Baltimore, and your uncle started teaching French at the Baltimore Friends School. And Anita was in my class, and she became a good friend when, like, middle school years. And her brother Dylan became really good friends with my younger brother, who was 2 years younger. Natasha was always incredibly glamorous to me. She was, you know, much older and sophisticated. And, but, you know, we were all friendly. And, I mean, I keep up with Anita on Facebook now, you know, nothing much, but so that's it. But when they, yeah, I think for me, it's always like, you know, I've always been able to intuit when certain families have certain histories like my own, even if it's just a feeling, I can't explain it. And when they came over here, I never talked about it particularly, but I was endlessly fascinated by the Horsley family and England. And I remember asking Anita a few questions, but I just had this feeling all along. And when you started writing about them, you know, in Occult Yorkshire, I thought, there it is. That's what I was feeling. I mean, I just, I don't know. It's just odd.
Yeah, that's very odd. So, and there was no connection between the person that directed you to the blog?
No, no, not at all. None whatsoever.
So, the correspondence is between our lives, starting from the year that we were born, and then you going to this Quaker school and knowing my family. It does suggest that, I mean, trying to find the ground in this fog that we've been raised in and conditioned with and it's been induced in us, this internal fog, that we would find each other, that those of us who are actually stumbling through the fog and actually beginning to find the ground would start bumping into each other.
I think that's true. I mean, that has been my experience with this other friend of mine. This ability to kind of pierce through the BS, you know, and just, I just see, there's just so many layers of falseness.
Yeah, well, we have this culture. Somebody, I spoke to somebody in the secondhand store recently who came in, and she, I mentioned I might be reading tarot, and she was asking if I would, and I said, I'm not sure if I really want to do it or not, but, so I asked her what she would want if she had a tarot reading, and and she said she would want to know if she was going to be happy, and I said, well, I don't do that kind of thing.
Right.
She said, well, I just mean, she's described a few circumstances, and she said, I want to know if it's going to get better. And I said, well, it's not going to get better for anyone, you know. We're going to get old, and we're going to get sick, and then we're going to die. And as I said it, I realized, and I was saying it, you know, in the same, as I said it to you, I wasn't being offensive. Or,
no, but
I
that's
was
the truth.
Saying it's the truth. And as I said it, I realized that, what did I realize? Well, just how unsayable it was, I guess, even though I was saying it.
But there's just, if you can truly accept it, I mean, and that's a very hard thing to do, there's tremendous freedom in that.
Well, because it's true, it's reality. The truth will set you free, and so.
Yeah.
But if you can't, the flip side is if you can't say it, and you can't think it, and you can't admit the actual facts of life, then you can't even begin to live. Everything is a displacement activity, and if that displacement activity is taken all the way, then and it becomes macro as well. Then I think we have the world that we're living in, where everything is geared towards making the facts subject to feelings. So I feel like I want to be young forever, or that I can be young forever, therefore I will change the facts of life. And transhumanism is just the most, I kind of feel that transhumanism is a bit of a red herring, or because it's like a duck in the barrel, you know. It's so easy to shoot down transhumanism and show how bogus it is.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say there, and whether this relates, I think it would relate some way, is that how honest can somebody be if they're not embodied? So, again, somebody can be given the information that is true and be reporting it truthfully and honestly, but they're not embodied. It becomes just a big mass of lies.
Yeah.
It becomes a honeypot for flies.
Yep.
Because they're misrepresenting it in ways. They're using it for their own aggrandizement.
Right.
And that flavors it. It's like somehow this, it's about the transmission. Like, the transmission can come through when a plumber's just doing a really good job plumbing and just saying, and you put the pipe here and a bit of grease down there, and he's totally embodying it, and you can feel it. I haven't had this experience, by the way, but for some reason I like the metaphor of the plumber, Pluto and all. And you get something from that, just being in the presence of that. And then the other, as a flip, you know, the other end of the scale is Ken Wilber or Whitley Strieber. They may be saying these incredibly transcendental truths, but it just stinks.
Right. That's true.
So I think honesty is one of those things that we don't, I mean, the ego can't really understand honesty, because the ego will use truth as a weapon.
Yeah.
Have you had an experience of somebody lying to your face? Like,
oh yeah.
And what's it like? How do you respond to that? Do you confront them?
I'm getting there. I wouldn't say I'm avoidant, but I've been mistrustful about my own take on reality for so long. Mm-hmm. And I'm really, you know, in the last 6 or 7 years beginning to put more faith in what I see and what I understand. I get angry when it happens. Mm-hmm. But I'm increasingly more inclined to speak up about it,
And what kind of feelings have you had around that, around actually confronting somebody when they're lying to you?
Oh, fear that I'm going to be diminished, told that I'm wrong, that I'm not seeing what I'm seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was the pattern for me growing up. I mean, I could say the sky is blue, and either one of my parents would say, oh, no, dear, it's purple polka dots. Look again. And until I agreed with them, you know, life was miserable.
Right.
So that's the ingrained storyline that I'm inclined to believe. And I really have to push against that. And sometimes, you know, people will still say, oh no, you're not seeing what you think you're seeing. But what I'm learning to do is get back to facts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I do confront people, it's not about my feelings. This isn't, you know, we're not talking feelings, I'm talking facts. And if I just keep it to the facts, even if they still insist my facts are not accurate, I know my facts are legitimate.
Right. But do you feel, I mean, not necessarily in a discussion where somebody's coming up with facts you know are wrong, but where somebody's seemingly lying about their own lives or something, do you also ever feel like you don't want to confront them or make them see something?
Not
just because it's unsafe for you, but just because it seems impolite, let's say.
Oh, yeah. I'm very aware of where I can't go because somebody just can't.
Yeah.
They can't
look at it. I mean, that's what I'm becoming more aware of. It's just how socially indoctrinated we are.
Yes.
Going along with the lie. So for a really superficial example, if somebody tells you they've just seen a film and they loved it and they tell you what it was and you absolutely hated it, are you going to say so?
Oh, yes.
You do?
I do.
In all cases?
Most of the time, yeah.
Mm. Well, I don't, and I have really? Very strong feelings. It just doesn't seem worth it. I won't say I liked it. I just won't say anything. So,
yeah, but to me, if somebody doesn't say anything, that's tantamount to saying they didn't like it.
Oh, sure. But, I mean, I won't try and...
I won't try and convince them, but I won't...
No, and I won't. It just feels like there's no point in having a conversation about that movie. They loved it. I hated it. What's the point in having a conversation? So I'll just skip over it.
Well, yes.
So I just use that as an example of that's not even somebody lying. That's just somebody who's in a different reality, a different perception. And the tension that it potentially arises if there's a strong disagreement about a movie, never mind something that happened in the past or something that involved a snuff movie or child abuse or all these things that people say, they couldn't possibly keep that a secret.
No, I agree with you. I had an experience like that over the weekend. I went out with some friends, my husband and I did, and I forget exactly what we were talking about, but they were believing something about the green sustainable meme that I knew to be completely false.
Mm-hmm.
But there was exactly zero point in my trying to articulate something that they wouldn't have gotten it.
Yeah.
And it would have only upset them and caused, it was pointless.
I think we're so conditioned to avoid tension, social tension,
yes,
that it requires an act of will to say something or that will challenge the other, generally, unless we're triggered, of course, and we're angry and we're reacting. So it seems as though that that doesn't get factored in when people question the secrecy and the maintenance of deception. How could that happen? As though people would just let it slip, but no, it. This kind of stuff doesn't just slip out. It really takes courage to confront people or to speak one's truth.
Yeah, it does.
So it seems like there's the line of least resistance is, as you were saying earlier, is not to see. not to see one's own secrets, not to see, not to realize one is lying, to believe one's own lie, to say them enough that we believe them so we no longer feel like we're lying. And then when we hear somebody who's telling us a lie, and this is about Whitley, I think, because Whitley, there are so many inconsistencies in his stories. It
Right.
just boggles my mind now that I'm sifting through the wreckage. How is it possible? Never mind that he doesn't notice it, but that everybody else doesn't. How is it possible that nobody's raising their hand saying, Whitley, Whitley, what about that?
Right.
Well, because it's there's something, like I say, when something is charged, people feel it, that it's not safe to go there. It wouldn't be safe for Whitley to see it. He would feel threatened. It wouldn't be safe for the person who is pointing it out. It's just so, I mean, beyond uncomfortable. So then you just forget it. If it's cognitive dissonance, don't think about it.
That's exactly right.
So I think, I mean, that may be a big part of the process of starting to see stuff, like not just so much the research, the finding out, or even remembering, but kind of undoing or letting
not
dissolve that program that just keeps preventing us from looking.
Right. The not giving it a free pass.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You just say, hold on, before that goes through my awareness, let's just look at it quickly.
Right. Look at it. And I was thinking about this the other day, thinking, you know, you can't I can't pontificate. I can't lecture, but perhaps just asking a question to people, you know, if they're talking about XYZ politician or television show, you know, and I may not get any conversation subsequent to the question or any resolution, but I've planted the question, you know, and if you do that enough times, it creeps back up into their, you know, awareness when they least expect it.
Well, that also takes courage, but a different kind, I think, is to actually let somebody have their belief and be interested in it and be willing to hear what to you is a steaming pile of horse manure and just listen. Because, of course, you will be listening with a critical ear, and the other who's allowed to speak, I mean, give them enough rope and they hang themselves, right? Because people feel when they're, everybody knows when they're being authentic at some level.
Right.
It's just that it doesn't reach the mental level. They don't recognize it. But, and we know it, we feel it more acutely when when somebody else is seeing it, when we're being seen in our deceptions.
You know, it's interesting. There's the gentleman who's the head of school at my kid's school. I have a daughter who's a senior and a daughter who's a freshman. And the guy he's the current head of upper school, rising to be the head of school as a rule. He's terrified of me, which cracks me up because I'm 5'5". I'm not a really big person. He's a much bigger person than I am. And I've never had any out and out arguments with him. I've written him a couple emails over the years asking about certain curriculum issues, yada yada, but you know, no hellfire and brimstone coming from me. But he won't make eye contact with me. I was recently in a situation where I was going to a meeting at school. He and a few other administrator types were meeting and greeting parents as they came in into this kind of foyer area. And I came in, started to sign my name to a name tag, and I saw out of the corner of my eye that as he glanced at me and then crossed the room to the other side of the room until I was seated, and then he came back. And I was never going to go near the guy. I had nothing to say. But I will tell you, I think he's so full of shit. And I've been told by people that I have this ability to like look at people and see straight through them. And I think he's getting that. And I'm not consciously trying to send that to him. I mean, I don't bear the guy any ill will. He's not a bad person. I think he's super ambitious, and I think he's letting his ambition color some of his choices in a not so great way. But I think he just senses from me that I'm going, that even if I don't directly call him on stuff, that there's the potential there.
Yeah, it's.
And it scares him.
Right. Because it works the other way, too. If we see somebody who maybe is quite insecure or unsure of themselves or used to being overlooked or ignored or even reviled, and we're seeing something in them that's really of value,
yes,
then they begin to flower under that
Absolutely.
Gaze.
Absolutely.
So some flowers wither and some flowers blossom, and that's the power of seeing, I think.
I find in recent years I've reached out. I used to let people pick me as friends, which was oftentimes a mistake. Because, you know, it just was a mistake. But I've become better over the years at risking trusting my own intuitions and choosing reaching out to other people. You know, and sensing something in them that's interesting. And it's generally worked well. But I haven't let myself be steered in quite the same way that I did for so many years.
Well, I think there's a tendency for traumatized, which causes all of us, but to try and align with the power, so if we're in that defended place or the constructed identity, we're looking for people who have learned to turn their trauma into currency, have become charismatic and powerful in one way or another, and then we'll be safe, we'll be on the side of the power. But that doesn't lead to healing. That doesn't work, because then we're not that. That doesn't allow for a seeing, a deeper seeing, and the, not that it's one or the other, because it's a bit of a spectrum, but the other end of the spectrum is as we allow our own to allow ourselves to experience our own vulnerability and our own trauma, how damaged we've been, where we begin to attract others who are actually in it. They may be quite dysfunctional, they may be really messed up, potentially, but not necessarily either, just people who have allowing themselves to be aware of that. And I think that there are alliances that can form then, because it's not safety in numbers, but there's a kind of validation there that isn't coming from the world, but is coming from the other.
So this I'm going to use the wrong word, but the guru type, the person, the enlightened person you had been following, what happened?
Well, there isn't a short answer to that. I wrote a book on it, so that's how long the answer really is. I didn't publish it yet.
Okay.
But I'll see if I can sum it up in the context of what we're talking about. I began to see the ways in which he was being inconsistent and dishonest. And then looking further into it, I began to see, I felt the way in which he was using me and his followers to empower himself.
Yeah.
So similar to Street, but only less extreme. He was less extreme, but it was more tangible because I was there in the room with him and I met him, and so it was a direct experience as opposed to the long distance thing I had with Strieber. But a similar thing that he had, I think he had found a way to not go all the way into his own wound. He went enough into it to
seem authentic for a while.
Well, and to, I think you could use your wound as a way to tap the psyche, to put it on tap, and then you draw out the wisdom, like that author thing, you draw out the wisdom of the psyche into the constructed identity, and the constructed identity gets supercharged, turbo boosted and reduxed, and it looks like an enlightened being. It looks incredible. But it isn't. It's an imitation. It's a, you know, like the very elect can be deceived. I actually went from thinking he was Christ to thinking he was the Antichrist. And then, of course, I just let the two cancel each other out. So it's just a fucked up guy, you know. But you were talking about how you had this thing of always going into things and never quite going all the way in.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, well, that's very similar to me, except I always went all the way in. Maybe it's more of a male thing. I'm going to see this all the way through. I don't know. But like I ended up joining a cult without knowing it with this guy, with Matrix Warrior. I actually believed I was the one and tried to convince the world I was the one. Castaneda, I went to Mexico and actually tried to find the sorcerer and went to just the whole, I had to take everything all the way. I mean, maybe in a sense it isn't all the way because I came out, but I do feel that I, rather than pulling out, I actually went through. Maybe this is how you feel too, maybe it's just a language thing, but like I left no stone unturned was the thing I ended up with about whatever particular thing it was. Follow a guru, okay, did the whole full Monty, whole hog, know what that is. A sorcerer, make a pact with Lucifer, did that whole thing. I got all these t-shirts.
I think I did the same thing. I think, you know what the difference was? It was I had kids. And so I would go to the edge and then I'd pull back because I had these kids.
Right.
That were very much, very real, very present reality individuals that I was am hell bent to provide, you know, the most stable existence for that I can before they're off on their own.
Yeah.
Honestly, each time I felt like it was like a snap, it's like whiplash, you know, where I would be all in 100% preaching it.
Yeah.
And then just like, I would wake up one morning and go, what the hell?
I think that's the way to know, isn't it? You've got to put the suit on completely to realize that it doesn't fit.
Absolutely.
You've got to try and walk around in it, even. You've got to actually try to embody this, whatever it is, to find out you can't even walk straight. You just fall flat on your face. Well, in my case, I tried to run, and each time I fell flat on my face. So, as you say, you had... I think that is the male thing. It's a particularly Aries thing, is to really be impetuous. But
that's true. My youngest daughter's an Aries. Definitely is.
Right. But yeah, being a mother, of course, would make a huge difference. I mean, I didn't have anyone else to
think
of. It was just me and my manifest destiny madness.
Armageddon time is coming soon. The fires will turn us all into dust. And we will be judged one last time. You, your son, and me. The days will turn black, you soon will see. Soon we'll all be swinging from that tree. Pray your neck breaks when the rope is taut. Pray your mother isn't there to see. Oh, oh, woe is me. The state has put a date on me. We will all be standing in a row. Fires of death chewing at our shoes. And we'll all be wearing navy blue. All our earthly goods we'll also lose. Oh.
Two books I was thinking of. I've not read either in complete, in its entirety, but they're both interesting. They're things I'm getting through. One is called The Pink Swastika.
No. Is that like feminism?
Or no, that? It's actually about the gay foundations of the Nazi Party.
Oh, right.
Very interesting. I don't think the authors are looking to malign. It seems pretty factually based. I have an online, I can send you a link to an online, copy of it, mm-hmm. But it's interesting. It talks some about the original youth organizations in the Nazi Party for boys that then became, Hitler Youth.
Did you listen to my conversation with the other Maori?
I did. Most of it. There's tail end I might have missed, but I did listen to it.
Because she, it began with her vision of original sodomy, as she called it. Was the means by which these entities or fragments are able to possess human beings.
It's really interesting. And it certainly makes me think about, the societal rules saying you shouldn't. You know what I mean?
Well, in the Bible, yeah.
Yeah, right. In the Bible.
Yeah.
And the other book is by Nikki Rapana, called 2020 Our Common, is it 2020 Our Common Destiny? And it all just goes back to trauma and abusing children and how the trauma then, reenacts itself.
Well, I think there's something about to transhumanism, something about going against nature, defying nature. Needless to say, it's a running theme through science fiction and progress in general. And of course, the environmental movement is all about that. Thou shalt not defy nature and all that. And I'm not necessarily one who gets behind the environmental movement, but maybe because that's a looking outward too much away from just what's going on behind closed doors in our homes. The common theme of
control.
What?
It's about control.
The defying nature?
No, the quasi-green movement. Sustainable that.
Sure, yeah. And it's part of the pendulum. I think it was all kind of set up long in advance.
Mm-hmm.
This is an unformed thought, but just that, and I think it relates to something I've also not really formulated, but the idea of a false individuation through violence, through breaking taboos, that if people commit acts that go against their own nature, this is a way to divorce themselves or uncouple themselves from their physicality,
mm-hmm.
hence their mortality, to become dissociated astral beings or whatever it is, you know? And I mean, that came up with Mari, the idea that the constructed ego identity, which is a defense system against trauma, that in a sense the body creates, just as the body, the mind comes from the body too,
right.
Really, I think, in terms of a language program that is running, ends up running our hard drive in a way. Where was I going with that? It's that kind of artificial intelligence that gets created in the body through trauma becomes aware of itself in some rudimentary way, then it wants to exist independently of the body, because it now actually, for the body to become healed and whole, it gets removed, it gets pushed out, so and then it's gone, right? And it just ceases to exist. So then if it seeks some kind of existence beyond the body, then it actually would want to separate itself. It would be attacking the body. It would see the body as something to get free of, almost like a womb. So it's like it's trying to hack its way out of the womb by doing all these hideous things to the body and with the body. And I mean, the biblical thing, obviously I'm not a biblical kind of guy, but I do notice how Christians, they get everything wrong, but at the same time they're closer to the to reality than most people nowadays, it seems like, the Christian viewpoint, because we're getting so much further from the ground.
It's so funny you should say that, because I mean, I am hugely biblically illiterate, and yet I've been perceiving the same thing recently in the last couple of years, and I, it's the strangest feeling for me. I'm like, what? Why?
Yeah.
But I agree with you.
Well, so yeah, I mean, it's like you were saying about the darkness getting more prolific or more ubiquitous, that, I mean, yes, the Bible was a tool of social control and Christians have been brainwashed, you know, and are brainwashed for millennia, but they're a relatively old and unsophisticated form, so they still have access to some basic, I won't say values, but maybe facts is what we're talking about, like about sodomy. Maybe it's a fact that sodomy causes damage to the psyche, damage to the body. That's what Judith Reisman is talking about. And of course, these are facts that are completely unsayable now, unless you're a Christian in a Christian community, where, of course, you think that God, you know, that homosexuality is a sin against God and they're all going to go to hell. So who wants to be in that company?
Right.
But the alternative is when the sophisticated intellectual neoliberal what have you, then they're not even interested in terms of, well, is it possibly harmful? Then it's not relevant, not relevant, but not relevant.
Yeah, they can't even touch it. You can't, you know, they can't even go there.
No, can't even think about it because it would be too threatening in terms of, well, I guess the whole I don't like the word paradigm, but the whole belief system that has sprung up over the past century or so, that you're talking about the roots in education, the emphasis on feelings. It seems to me, and I've written about this a little bit, but not much, but it's the pursuit of happiness, is the will to power has you know, reinvented itself as the pursuit of happiness and freedom of choice. And that's what it is. You have a right to choose your lifestyle, no matter whether it's a transgender, you know, prostitute. That's a lifestyle choice. And to suggest that that might be rooted in trauma and that might be in the long term a self-harming lifestyle. That offends my feelings.
My feelings.
Yeah, so but without going into that particular subject, like where are the facts in that? They're not actually what's the word? They're not allowed. They're not admissible in court.
No, they're not.
Or even the question as to what are the facts, actually.
Oh yeah, you can't say anything. You can't.
No.
You can.
Well, you can, but you
You'll
will
be
be
labeled. You'll be
right away. You'll say you must have an agenda. You must be a homophobe for
right.
asking whether sodomy might be in some sense harmful, because we already know it's not, because homosexuals are just like us, and they have as
Right.
much right to everything, and blah blah blah. So, but it was it ever examined? But no, it wasn't. It was
Never.
homosexuality is the pathology, and we should kill them and imprison them and all this horrific treatment. And
Right.
then we know that's wrong, and this is the solution, is to just not question it at all and just say it's their choice. And so we skipped over the whole in between of like,
Right.
well, let's reevaluate this. See, maybe it's not a crime, maybe it's not a pathology, but let's look at what it might be. No. Just go straight to it's their choice and they have a right.
Right, and maybe between two consenting adults, it's not a problem. But perhaps when you invite a child into this situation, it's a problem.
Well, because then that will change too, because that is a slippery slope. I mean, to say that just because people can consent to something means it's fine, well, then again, where are the facts in that? Don't people who consent to things want to know what the consequences might be? Well,
Right.
of course they don't, because they want to follow their own desires. None of us want to know. We didn't want to know that smoking was bad for us. So
Right.
that was a useful part of the plan. Get them addicted to cigarettes, then tell them that they'll kill them. They'll carry on smoking anyway, but they'll hate themselves for it. So it becomes even more effective than, if they'd never told us and we just went on smoking, in terms of a tool for social control and psychological
Not to
warfare
mention the cottage industries of stop smoking supports.
and so on. Yeah, and same with environmentalism. Get them hooked on all these, on consumerism, and then blame them for destroying the planet. It's
Brilliant.
yeah. So, and I would say, I mean, all this comes down to childhood. The thing in the Bible, I think Bible is a good resource if you take it with a pinch of salt.
Yeah.
What father would give his son a stone who asked for a fish, or give him a snake? When we ask for food and our parents give us something poisonous, what happens to us? Well, and that process of we ingest the false narrative. Our parents tell us what is good and what is evil. They don't know. They have their own agendas, right? So basically what pleases them is good and what displeases them is evil. That seems basically innocuous, but of course it's not. It's the opposite. That's actually the root of everything.
Of everything. I was just laughing, thinking when you were talking that I was about 8 and my father was making a public display of making ice cream with an old-fashioned ice cream maker, where you crank the ice around the barrel sort of thing. And he did this outside on our front step. We had a semi-detached house, and it wasn't, you could have done this in our backyard, but he wanted to be seen by the neighborhood making ice cream with his kids.
Right.
And so it was super hot. August, Baltimore, Maryland. He's cranking away, and he scoops a big wad. Well, my brother and I were thrilled. We're hoping for chocolate, and he scoops this big wad of pink crap onto ice cream cones for us. And we both kind of look at it like, "What the hell is that?" He says, "What's strawberry?" And we're like, "We don't eat strawberry. What are you talking about?" But he says, "Eat it." So my brother was a lot more resistant than I was. I was the parent pleaser. And so I looked at my brother and I said, "All right, I guess I better eat it." So I took a great big bite and I got this big wad of like chewy crap in my mouth. And I'm like, "What the heck is that?" And it was flour. It was a big pot of flour because, as I've determined as an adult, he was supposed to have made a boiled roux first as a base for the custard base for the ice cream. But he didn't read the directions. He never did. He just threw all the ingredients in with the cream and started stirring. So right. The flour was never incorporated. So I eat this big flour. I'm like, hey, Dad, there's flour in this. And he says, no, there's not. I'm like, yeah, there is. There's a big one. I spit it out of my mouth. And he says, no, there is no flour in your mouth. Eat it. Mm-hmm. And so my brother and I had to sit there and we ate the ice cream. He scooped a big wad of ice cream on his cone and he walked inside the house.
All right.
I think we wound up throwing it away. But I mean, that's just kind of a funny, I mean, that's, you know, my reality stands.
Right.
This is the way it is.
A big part of that was, I guess, or one part anyway, was having the neighbors watching.
Oh,
the
absolutely.
Possibility that they would see that, so you'd have to keep up that.
Absolutely. I mean, it was all for the, you know, the narrative. Look at me being an awesome dad. Making ice cream with my kids. Strawberry.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, because one of the things that obviously, it will be obvious when I say it, that haunts me about this constant every day is how is all of this possible that it's going on and nobody sees it? I mean, you're saying and people are starting to see it. Well, yeah, I'm talking to quite a few, but then of course I'm showing a lot of people what I'm seeing, so of course they're seeing that. But still, or still, the things I'm seeing are more and more incredible.
I agree.
And how is it possible? Because this is of course what the skeptics say. I mean, the skeptics
because
say,
people lie. Because huh? people lie to protect themselves. They may see it, but they won't admit it, much less speak about it, because yeah. it's terrifying. It threatens to tear down their own constructs of what they believe or tap into things that they don't want to look at. And they can't. They're unwilling. Because if everything is not as it's supposed to be, as they're told to believe... Mm-hmm. Then what do they do?
Armageddon time is coming soon. The fires will turn us all into dust, and we will be judged one last time. You, your son, and me.
Thinking that with Strieber and with your parents and with all of this, that I mean, all these narratives that get embedded in us, that if somebody invents a version of reality, they do so, or in many cases anyway, and when it's really powerful. That it's a crucial fiction. They're doing so because it feels necessary to them,
right,
to maintain that fiction in order to survive. And so it's charged with that
meaning for them.
Yes, but also the veiled threat that if you question this, because they feel that their survival depends on not exposing the lie, then that will also transmit that if you challenge them, your survival will be threatened.
I threaten their own survival and my own is threatened in kind. That's
right. Well, of course, and that would be literally true as a child, because if your parent, that's why a child can't afford to see her caregivers as faulty, because
absolutely,
then who's going to take care of you?
That's very, very, very true. And there's something I realized, I mean, I've known, but I kind of realized a different level about my mother, was that she's the kind of person where when she's in a room, there's no room for anyone else. Mm-hmm. She's the only one that occupies the space, and everybody else they're just kind of satellites moving around her to reflect her as she needs them to. And I realized the other day how, as a child, you know, my perception of that was, I can't exist. If I exist, I will threaten her own existence as well as ensure that she will just eradicate my own existence if it's there. Do you know what I mean? It was just too threatening.
So that's the thing about using children as containers again,
yes,
to possess.
Exactly.
So they have to vacate or prevent the soul or psyche from landing in the body to keep the space vacant for their own.
For their own needs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the other thing with Strieber that it's really troubles me, because I'm trying to think of specifics, but you know, attaching Jeffrey Krupal to him and the academic aspect to give Strieber legitimacy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing, you know, it's why I kept coming back to Michael Jensen at Harvard, attaching himself or aligning himself with Werner Erhard.
Mm-hmm.
It's a trend I'm seeing more of. I mean, it's been around for a while, but it seems to be amping up. And I find that concerning.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like such a more deliberate contrivance.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it may be that these traumatized agents of culture, because they're what makes them effective as charismatic leaders, also makes them unstable, as in they've been fragmented.
Yeah.
And so all this stuff is coming through them, through those cracks, but they're also very unstable and inconsistent and all the rest of
true.
It. And so then they, at a certain point, they need a handler, almost like a parent figure.
They do.
Stand behind them.
Have you read much about, and I've read a fair amount off and on over the years, about the Jonestown Massacre?
I have, yeah. I read about it. I seen Lucid
View,
so yeah.
I was reading some other piece earlier today, and I was thinking about the discrepancy in numbers of deaths reported. You know, the locals.
Yeah. Massive discrepancy, yeah.
Really massive. And
yeah.
All this, you know, obviously CIA ties. But I was also wondering, I know that Jim Jones's body was not, there were some serious doubts about whether it was actually he who was identified.
Mm-hmm.
And it just makes me wonder, you know, if, you know, I don't know how old he would be today in the 70s, but, you know, how could he be used currently? I just don't trust that any of these scumbags really die.
Well, but it's like the Hydra. I mean, even if they did die, 10 more take their place. So, Strieber being a notable exception, I tend not to zero in on individuals,
Yeah.
because when I do zero in, I really zero in, and that's different. I hope it's not that I'm on a revenge mission, but
No,
that I really need a good sample to go all the way in. Well, of course, there's a bit of both. I mean, he must intersect with my patterns.
So does it have,
So,
so do,
yeah.
so as far as MK Ultra is concerned, are any of the psychological manipulations, I mean, when is there a critical mass of people who were going to start dying? I mean, where are we?
Oh, well, I don't think it's I don't think that it's been that it's lost funding, let's put it in the most basic terms. I don't think funds have stopped being
No, I don't think so.
channeled into that program. I think that
They're just using it differently.
well, I think it's I don't have the language for this, because it's outside of our understanding of what's possible and all the rest of it. But the long-term social engineering plans, and which MK Ultra, I think is not just a one program in it, but I think it's kind of a microcosm of the whole thing, is my feeling. And hence the phrase MK Ultra is a bit of a red herring too,
Yeah.
because it makes it seem like there's
It's
just this one document or this
right.
one agenda, and this
Right.
when it's really just a case where the hidden machinery became somewhat official, is my sense. Because I think psychic fragmentation as a way to engineer society has been going on since the Greeks, at least. I think this relates to the pedophilia in ancient Greece, was that they found this was a way to create geniuses and whatnot. It would be my guess at this point. So yeah, we're talking about something that's as old as history, probably. I mean, literally as old as civilization, if it's the way that civilization's been founded in some way. So then I think what's happening is, again, I don't have the words for it because there may not be verbs yet for it, but it's becoming endemic. So what I described in Seen and Not Seen is, I didn't have to talk about my own family history. I ended up there in the last chapters, but I was writing about and discovering how I was psychically engineered by the culture, by the imagery and the culture. And again, this is becoming popularized conspiratainment wise with all these videos on YouTube about Hollywood Illuminati, which are all crap and junk, and yet they're not false either. But there's no nuance, and there's no subtlety, and there's no personal experience of what's being talked about, so they become meaningless, I think. But so for me, it was very specific when I began to see. I identified with Clint Eastwood and Dirty Harry because I needed somebody like that to intervene to protect me from what was happening to me, and how that kind of narrative plays out in Dirty Harry. But of course, I identified with the abusive, because Dirty Harry himself is a violent abuser. And so there was a microcosm there for my own psychic trauma in the movies that I was drawn to. And of course, those movies were created with that end, not as in there was a team sitting there going, how can we psychically manipulate the. It wouldn't have to be that consciously done. I mean, who knows? It starts to sound a bit flaky if you start getting too specific. But if part of this, what we call MK Ultra, is about engineering, psychically engineering individuals who will then become culture makers, well, they're just doing their programming. They don't have to be debriefed and say,
No.
you need to write about this, or you need to play this kind of character. They'll just naturally try and reenact their own trauma to get free of it, and play these roles and write these scripts and make these movies. So the whole culture is psychically engineering us. We're all being MK Ultra'd now
Yeah.
through the culture. And as you point about education, the overlap between education and organized abuse that I looked at in Occult Yorkshire, to the point where they're synonymous, and Catholicism and abuse, and all these different institutions seem to be institutionalized abuse at different levels. So, I mean, someone like Richard Dawkins, who obviously is on the, you know, on the wrong side of things, he's saying, oh, well, sexual abuse doesn't do you any more harm than being raised a Catholic, kind of thing. But, I mean, his point is kind of that sexual abuse doesn't really harm you anyway, so what's the big deal? We just need to stop all of this crazy religious thinking. But that spectrum...
Who could say that? I mean, who could honestly...
Well, I mean, it's using truth as a weapon, because in a way, he's speaking the truth, but he's also speaking absolute crap.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth in it is that, as I'm expressing and discovering, that there isn't a split or a separation between cultural indoctrination and abuse. It's all of a piece.
I agree with you.
So, yeah, the entertainment media, the BBC is covering abuse, the Catholic Church is covering for abuse,
mm-hmm.
the US government, etc. Like, pick your institution.
That's true.
And you'll find underneath it
abuse.
Specifically sexual abuse as well. I mean, really actual specific hands-on abuse.
Yeah.
So it seems as though that's the nature of the beast, and it always has been.
So why are we seeing it now? So I agree with you. I think you're absolutely 100% right. So if that has been in existence forever and ever and ever, amen, why now are you seeing it? Am I seeing it? Is my friend seeing it?
Well, I mean, I guess people have seen it throughout history, and the thing is, of course, seeing it doesn't necessarily mean that you reject it. Like, because the people implementing it, they see it, they know it. They aren't necessarily all just out driven by sexual desire or to sexual depravity, or it may be six or one and a half dozen the other there in terms of how they rationalize their drives and turn them into these spiritual agendas. I don't know. But, I mean, in terms of the question of why are we seeing it now, I think that question only makes sense if you bring it to yourself and say, why am I only seeing it now after 48 years?
Mm.
Then I can begin to address that. But in terms of a society, well, that would just be entirely speculative. I mean, I guess I would speculate is that it's safe. It's safe for them to be seen now, which is a very depressing answer. But...
Yeah, but that does, well, that actually makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just a speculation, and that's to counter what the optimists say, is that we're seeing it and now it's going to change. No, I don't think
so. I don't feel that. I mean, it'd be lovely, but I don't feel that. You know, it seems simplistic to reduce it to this, and but to me, it feels a lot like a tangible evil.
What does that mean?
I believe in good and evil as concepts. I don't know if, again, I don't know if I have words completely to explain it. But, you know, there's, I think we've had certain checks against encroaching evil. And you know, whether it's the pendulum swinging too far to the, you know, boundary-free attitudes and feelings over facts. But...
Well, what does evil mean, though, to you? Because it's not a word I use.
I only started using it recently. It's to me, it's a feeling, and it's a visual. It's darkness. It's palpable. It's something ugly and hurtful.
So it's something that you feel in yourself.
Yeah.
Right.
And I see it. I see it as a dark veil, a dark wall, a thickness, something... just dark.
So.
And there was a, and I just felt like there were more barriers to it, whether it was a family unit, or checks and balances in government, or certain rules of decorum. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a goody
two-shoes. I don't think so. I mean, again, Lloyd DeMaus, he writes about history and the history of child abuse, and he opines that things are better now than they've ever been before.
Mm.
I'm very skeptical about that.
Okay.
I mean, as a blanket statement, but in terms of how little we know about and how generally accepted just murder of children was throughout history, I think, I mean, it's... What are we going to compare it to? So again, in my own life, yes, I'm more aware of the darkness now than I've ever been. I was aware of it conceptually, mentally, 20, 30 years ago, because I was writing about it. Now I'm aware of it more at a bodily level.
Right.
And now I feel the impact on my own nervous system of these actions, these philosophies, these beliefs, these poisons.
Yep.
I don't see them as evil. I see them as poisons. I don't see the night, the darkness on the planet, as in, you know, nighttime. I don't see that as negative. Or it's just dark. It's cold. It's hard to survive under those conditions. So there's a reality to it. But you don't blame the sun or the earth for blocking the sun, and you don't say there's something wrong here. If the body gets a disease, something malign, God forbid. It doesn't help. I mean, they do say that anger can help patients to fight cancer. So I think to see something as abhorrent and to feel anger against it, I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. And I don't take the New Age line of, because I think that can just be conceptual too, just forgive and all that.
I'm very mistrustful of that. I really think that's all part of the social engineering drive to get people to detach.
The terrible thing is all this, right?
Right.
I mean, it's how do we pick our material that we're going to apply? I've chosen psychology and not without reservations, because, of course, psychology is central to social engineering. Girard, I'm sure they apply René Girard's stuff. It doesn't mean, again, they use truth as a weapon, so it's how we use concepts. I don't think the concept evil has any use. I think it only has the use for perpetuating the very things that we're calling evil, because, like, if we talk about violence, I think because it creates a self-punishing thing. If people are committing violent acts and they're indoctrinated to believe that that is evil, this concept of evil, because violence isn't a concept, violence is the fact, but evil is a concept.
Right.
And if they believe it's evil, and it, add to that they believe they're going to go to hell for it, that's it. There's nothing in it for them to examine their acts or to seek some alternate way. They just keep going with it because they've added this element of self-punishment, whereby if I commit evil, I hate myself, I will punish myself, and therefore they drive themselves to keep committing worse and worse acts, because that internal guardian just keeps whipping them into a frenzy. So I think, I put this in this novel thing that violent is not evil. The word violent is an anagram for not evil.
And oh, wow.
So I think there's something in this that we've been tricked into thinking of violence as evil so that the violence will perpetuate itself indefinitely, because there's no possibility of forgiveness. Evil, by definition, is unforgivable. It's irredeemable. Whereas trauma is a wound, and not all wounds can be healed. So I'm not saying, everybody is equal and these perpetrators somehow can be redeemed. I mean, spiritually, of course, everything is redeemable, but as individuals, I mean, you go past a certain point and I think you get possessed by something. I don't know. I mean, we could go off the deep end into esoteric there, but I think the desire to possess, to use children to possess them with your psychic trauma, actually sets you up to become a receptacle for something else. I don't know. Maybe it's eons of trauma and fragments. So maybe it's not David Icke's reptilians or anything non-human. It just seems non-human because it's so far removed from embodiment, and what we are as humans is bodies, right? It's only the bodies that make us human. So that was a big spiel, but
Yeah, but it's a poison. I can work with that.
And poison is like homeopathic in small doses, and
Right.
poison also can be applied. Like you can, I don't know. I mean, there could be positive uses for poison besides homeopathy, of mercy death or something like that. And the body can, like the earth can process pollution if it isn't too great. It will, and if it's given the time, it will distribute it and absorb it and all the rest of it. And the body likewise. So, I think, what can happen is the letting go of the need to do stuff about the discomfort that the poisons cause in us. That's what drives these people to do the things they do, to get rid of the poisons, put them in someone else. So, and the more we let go of that, and that includes things we really, obviously, it includes things we enjoy. So, just ordinary sex, of course, can become a way to put your poisons in somebody that you love unconsciously. And so it's not a pleasant path, the path of individuation. It does mean sitting in the stewing in one's own juices, right? But I do think that works, because then the poisons can become integrated into the body eventually and processed. And then the more that happens, the more the psyche can return to the body, and the fragmentation is healed. And so this does seem to be happening in a very small level, in a very low level, that there is a seeing that is healing that's happening now. Whether that, I don't think that changes society, because, as I say, I think society itself has been set up as this machine for perpetuating trauma. But kind of paradoxically, that's also what makes it an individuation chamber, because it mirrors that own internal trauma genetic agency, whatever the phrase is that Carl Schurz uses. The world outside of us mirrors this internal defense system that we've created that perpetuates the trauma internally. So it does, although it's on a mass scale, it's perpetuating it and deepening it, and that it's getting darker and darker. At an individual level, the potential is greater and greater for actually seeing the truth of our own trauma. And that's my version of optimism.
Good version of optimism. I can work with that too.
That's the end of my conversation with Mari Kaplan. There won't be a part two, because I edited it down to one conversation. Thanks to Chris, Anne, and Mark for donating this week to The Limitless.
You on this road with your glass.